your head and your feet hurt. Baby, let me rub you down, fix you a hot meal, kiss you wherever you like. I can improve how you feel. Ooh, I'm your medicine woman, and any pain will be easy. Cause I got what you need. Ooh, I'm your medicine woman, and any pain will be easy. Cause I got what you need. No exception to Tylenol pill. Tell them better than all of them. And what I got is long overdue. Been waiting all day just to medicate you. Gone, baby, relax your mind. Everything is gonna be alright. Cause you know, Big Daddy, yeah, 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 I keep your medicine tight. Your medicine woman, and any pain will be easy. Cause I got what you need. Ooh, I'm your medicine woman, and any pain will be easy. Cause I got what you need. You don't have to do nothing, Daddy. But I'm showing up in something, Daddy. Do you need me to ride it, Daddy? Or just ease up the side of Daddy? Yeah. Let me know. Cause either way it goes. Your medicine woman, and any pain will be easy. Cause I got what you need. Oh, yeah. I'm your medicine woman, and any pain will be easy. Cause I got what you need.
Hello, everybody. This is Vertical Live Radio, and today we're featuring A Taste of Ink Live with Charles Clifford III. Our intro music today was Medicine Woman by Mocha Blue Blaze. She's an Arizona resident, everyone. She's one of our favorite indie artists here in Arizona. And we have a program crew today, which has been part of the standard for the month of April, which is National Poetry Month. Our poetry quote comes from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion. So medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for. So today, I want to introduce you to Charles Clifford Brooks. He's a native of Athens, Georgia. He grew up running wild among trees and open air all over his home state. He began to write as an escape, and his passion for letters grew over time into short stories and humorous nonfiction. He became known for a smaller literary circle. His first book, The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics, became a means of introduction to a much wider audience. Before turning teaching and creative writing into a means of financial survival, Clifford worked as a bookseller, juvenile probation officer, and a social worker. So today I'm glad to introduce Charles Clifford. Hi, Clifford. How are you?
I am good. How are you doing, Celeste?
I'm doing fine. I'm just really pleased to have you on our program today. And I had a chance to be reading your book, Athena Departs, and the poetry is pretty awesome. So I was happy to have a chance to have you on with us today. So let's not keep our people waiting. So let's talk about some beginnings. So Cliff, tell me a little bit about yourself and your family growing up in the South.
It was, looking back, we often get caught in what I call the disease of nostalgia, where it's not quite as rosy as we see it today, but I don't stand apart, and no pun intended, many ways. But my childhood, when I look back, really was idyllic. I grew up in Athens, most of that spent about 20 minutes south of there in Oglethorpe County. And I had countless hours of affection and support and wilderness and open air to feed my creative spirit. And we were not, my daddy always said, it's always good to be far enough away that they can't see you sitting on your back porch. But if you get robbed, you can holler and your neighbors come help. So that really worked in my favor, because as a child, I had a hard time keeping my clothes on as a little nudist, and I would run around constantly getting into trouble. My friends even say today it takes a village to raise a Clifford. But my youth was unique in that there were no race lines. There was no prejudices. There was open questions. There was music all the time. And these are some of the foundations, the support of my parents, the love of education and of knowledge, the appreciation of culture and other cultures. These things I was injected with and live for from my youth to today. And all of that prominently in the poetry that I began in my first book, The Draw of Broken Eyes and World of Metaphysics, and continues with Athena Departs and Exiles of Eden.
Wow, it sounds like a wonderful childhood, a childhood that every child would have. So I could see where you found your love of books and storytelling and reading. How does that relate to your spiritual practice and what you do?
Was just blessed. I was blessed with the fact that I know that, especially once I got to college, I went to the private faith-based institutions first year, freshman in Campbell University, North Carolina, in the thriving metropolis of Buies Creek, and then Shorter College in Rome, Georgia. When I got there, I found, and I mean, I was not blind to this fact, but I found so many that were introduced to religion and to the spirit in a very heavy-handed, very fear of God kind of way. And I was able to see, without judgment, I mean, I preface that all the time, it's more of just a simple observation. My churches, first was in Lexington, Georgia, Baptist Church, and then Baptist up here in Pickens County. Both of the ministers that I grew up with were happy men, and would never talk about damnation, and they never talked about hell. I mean, we were aware of these things, but at home, I was also welcomed to ask why. Now, I'm sure my parents came to bemoan that decision, because I used that to the hilt, because I was always extremely curious. But looking back, I never had to be convinced that God was real, and I do believe, without going overhanded, you know, on Walden Pond Thoreau on this, but when you are able to play in nature and you're able to spend quality time by yourself and then with the full support of your family, I didn't have to be convinced that God was real. I remember when I heard these terms and I heard the names for these things: God, Jesus Christ, forgiveness, love, acceptance, patience. These ideas came naturally to me, and I don't stand up as this is an academic pursuit, although that does help and does continue to help me today with the way I believe. The childlike innocence of faith and the way that I view God, again, plays a mainline role in my belief that in poetry, it's, number one, needs to be accessible, as it was for me to learn, as it was for me to have information at my fingertips, to be able to go to my parents and ask, or if they didn't know, that they could direct me to somewhere to do the research. But this erudition balanced with the free thought of free time. Mm-hmm. People want to hear that life is rough sometimes, but in the end, like any blues song that's worth its salt, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. Mm-hmm. And it's a theme that plays through the Bible. It's one that is mirrored in life. That I remember to talk about today, I recently saw, this is how hooked up I am, I follow God on Twitter. And anybody wants to see this, it's actually true. But there was a tweet, now I know this did not come from God, but there was a question like posed to this tweet, is life fair? And it said, mm-hmm. short answer, no. Long answer, no. It's not going to come easy. Knowledge, experience, these things are what we what toughen us up. But you need to maintain a childhood innocence, mm-hmm. or the world becomes very grim. It becomes very small. Mm-hmm. And from my youth, I literally write in my stories that are designed as poetry, that people can walk alongside me, hold my hand, put their arm around me, that we can walk as friends, as family, that we can take this journey together, that the reader can then see themselves in the poem, that they can wander around in it and sometimes take something completely different from the poem. Mm-hmm. And my meaning doesn't have to be the same as what conclusion they came to. You know, that's where the magic, again, all this goes back to kind of a childlike wonder. The magic of poetry, that ability that someone can come to me and say, I love that poem, I love the way that you told it, I love the way that you read it, but I thought that it meant this. And whatever that this is, as long as it's not, you know, I thought you were talking about slapping kids and old people, it's okay, as long as it's not that, you know, it's fun to see where people take it and go with it. And, mm-hmm. you know, coming from a long line of storytellers, and it is not only exclusive to the South, but we do have this this specialized way of telling stories. My mama and I are the exact same, and my daddy to an extent. If you tied our hands behind our backs, we couldn't tell a story. And I love that phrase because we have to talk about, and you can't see me, but our hands apart, like how wide the water was, and we have to go through the woods like a snake with your hands, and the way that you use your expressions and your whole body, like Thelonious Monk behind the keyboard, the whole body moves to tell a story, and that draws people in. And as far as poetry is concerned, it is often read like a speak and spell, and or so quickly that the reader can't absorb anything from it. So it's about slowing down, getting their attention, mm-hmm. using words mm-hmm. and phrases and imagery that's colloquial in terms that are not just to one certain region. I've seen some poets and many novelists get so wrapped up in getting the way people talk in an area so on their mind that it really exempts an enormous amount of people from really getting into it. It's more about the accent than it is about what they're saying. And mm-hmm. okay. I tried to walk that fine line. And mm-hmm. God has really given me, God has blessed me in so many ways. And to sit here and even be on this show to be talking about poetry, to be able to sit back and share that and what God has done for me, it doesn't put an obligation in the sense of that it's a weight, but it gives a responsibility, mm-hmm. I think, as a privilege to put into poetry the way God's helped me, and to tell it through stories.
Okay. So what was the turning point for you from becoming, working as a probation officer or a social worker, what was the turning point that, you know, pushed you to pursue your passion to write?
Well, Celeste, once upon a time, I love my work. I don't have any children, but I've always had a passion to work with kids. I understand mm-hmm. kids. I don't know what that says about me, but I understand, you know, how where they're coming from. You know, they're like mm-hmm. you know, little, they're like brilliant little puzzle boxes. And mm-hmm. I worked 6 years with the Georgia Department of Juvenile Justice, and then 4 years with the Department of Family and Children Services. And both, in their own rights, are marvelous institutions. Now, I don't take from either one of them. But I'd moved to Athens within my last year with the state, and I can clearly remember this voice that said, "Cliff, look, man, you've just vested 10 years. You know, and when you work for the government in the state, I don't know how it is anywhere else in the union, but in Georgia, you at 10 years, you're kind of set." And all this feeds into how my parents are like, what did that fool just say? At 10 years, you're kind of set. You aren't kind of, you are, right. As far as like your retirement and all that. And it wasn't fear of being in something too deep or resigning myself to a life of negative, bleak emptiness. But in a respect, that emptiness was real. For me, those that are able to do this work for a lifetime, I give mad respect. But it was eating away at me. And I talk about it at length, literally, in an epic called The Gateman's Hymn of Ignoratium. At the end of my first book, that's about to be released by Kudzu Leaf Press. And my first, my current two are also available through Kudzu Leaf Press. But I realized in the construction, the writing of this long epic poem called The Gateman's Hymn of Ignoratium, that I was getting worn out. I was giving out. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, when you get to that point and you work with people, especially kids and families where there's abuse going on sometimes, you become numb and apathetic. And I think that it opens the door for terrible things to happen. And I could feel that grinding down on me. And this voice said, "You know, Cliff, I just moved back to Athens to kind of reconnect with my daddy and his side of the family, and they're still all down there in Athens." And this voice, this urge that said, "You know, Cliff, you do this thing now, or you stop talking about it. And I knew that I couldn't do both. You know, so often you hear, "Well, you can't have everything." And we as people, not that we're greedy, but it's like, "Well, you know, no, you can." Well, no, you can't. And that's not a bad thing. And the respect that I'm speaking now, that I couldn't, when you deal with people, you, in so many other jobs, you can, as a bookseller or a plumber or a home inspector, anything that's more like the it's more service oriented and less about people, you do have that bliss of leaving it at the office. But when you work with people, especially sometimes in extremely awful situations, you can't, because when you go home, and there's a poem I read about that today, but it's when you go home, you're still thinking, "What's that kid going through? What's that mom going through? What's that little boy going through?" So I knew I couldn't focus on writing a book, that I couldn't be the poet, the writer that I wanted to be, and continue to work for the state. And it's not that the government's keeping me down, but I also wanted to, because I believe in absolute honesty in writing, that there's been some stuff I've been through in life and things that I've done in life that I'm not ashamed of, but that the government really wouldn't shine to, as they say here. So for multiple reasons, I will forget today. It was faith. I mean, I'm not delusional. My dog didn't tell me this. I remember thinking, "I know this is what I got to do," and I knew that if I didn't do it, that if I didn't make that choice, I would lead that life of a bleak emptiness at the end. And to me, there's nothing short of misery than to be at the end of your life and laying there on your bed, looking death in the face and saying, "What if? What if? What if?" Mm-hmm. Regret is the one thing that, pain, as far as like abuse, PTSD, these things, every other type of agony you can work through either by yourself, with God, with a therapist, or all of these things. Typically, it's all of them combined that get you past them. But regret, you'd literally need a time machine to go back and fix. And so I decided, when I was in Athens, I was living alone, that I would take that leap, and it saved my life. And no matter how firm I was in my faith, I remember when I went to my family and said, "Hey, y'all, look, I know I just made 10 years with the state and life is good and I'm supposed to be happy, but I'm going to go cut grass and work with my uncle in this landscaping company and write poetry. I'm out." Drop the mic. And I remember them thinking, "I thought he quit drinking. What did he just say? What? What did you say? And now there were many. Now don't get it twisted. I didn't. Mm-hmm. There were many what I call 4 a.m. what the hell moments where you're looking at yourself in the mirror going, what the hell did I do? How the hell am I going to eat?
Right.
What was I thinking? Mm-hmm. But there was this faith. I mean, when they say, and again, I'm still inching my way along this faith, this path of better faith. But when they say leap of faith, it's not a small jump. It's not a couple of quick steps with one foot back, ready to go home. You have to jump in and do it. You have to get into it waist deep, if not up to your neck, and live it, or don't even try it at all, because that honesty that's needed, that's quintessential to good poetry, good art, won't be there if you're counting on a safety net.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I go any further, I'd like you to read us one of your poems, and I'd like you to read In the South from Athena Departs. Since we started out talking about your home, so I'd like our audience to hear some of that. Yeah, I'd like them to hear that poem.
Okay. This poem is called In the South, and this happened, it's at the end, it's the last poem in Athena Departs, and justifiably so, because it was the last one I actually wrote while I was in Athens. And many people, I'm steeped in mythology, and my faith, of course, those being two completely different things. But the title of the book, Athena Departs, is really to be taken literally. This is when when my first book, The Draw Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics, left off. This one picked up, and it picks up when I was leaving Athens. And the poem In the South is about when I was downtown, and it's quite literal. There's a man that's still there. He's quite famous in the area. He has schizophrenia, and he was playing Vivaldi. He can play the violin like angels sing, and you could see it was so surreal. It was after a University of Georgia football game, go Dogs, and we were downtown, and they were just, I mean, after a football game in Athens, it's there are literally thousands of people, and there was this crush of it. My heart was broken, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Not by that or losing the football game, but there was the story of a love that did not come to fruition that I realize now, and actually not long after that, I realized it wasn't supposed to be. But it was about letting things go. And all of it, as I was working through this pain, this man was playing Spring in Vivaldi's Four Seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the South, cicadas offer no history, only a permanent revolution of seasons, a melody, a natural catastrophe. Our loose thoughts combine. After I told you about the blonde vagabond playing Vivaldi downtown, with only his toes touching the ground, how the soothing sounds of those strings were his roots among us that challenged reality. In it, he was the only soul entangled. His violin was spotless, though he himself was not. He was a stalagmite, vapor, the remnants of awful parent. Vacant eyes, gaping mouth, unkempt, he was another time-wasted thing, disintegrating from an inability to remain tangible. Shadows crowding round, same as you see on the road home through Yazoo, Waco, and Monroe. Impassable because your headlights always shine behind. Nevertheless, a surreal sight on Hancock, that man like the dark wood of a dining table. Primer still smelling of orange blossoms, wiped up in dusty plumes. Letters propped up against a vase beneath the bowing heads of crested irises. Nearby is grandfather's photo in black and white. Expensive parchment for better letters is unused. Today, for me, a lady is a fading reflection as I look out from my sturdy frame. The air is filled with cynicism. You see, for years, I collected specters in a blue Bible. And tonight, I give them all to Vivaldi's Madman. Those motels, the lying sleep. This time to mend if they are forgotten secrets between us and lunacy. They are no longer yours. They are no longer mine. Cicadas. They play to help remember. Keeping time the way a metronome does. Not to pass the hour, but to hone its rhythm. They are blades to slice away what I don't want. In the South.
Wow, thank you. Thank you. You're a great reader as well. Thank you for reading that for us. So tell me, what are some of the things that you used to research this book, and who are some of the people you met along the way while researching Athena Departs?
First and foremost, I love to start off with a story. I had a buddy come into town. It was my last 8 months in Athens. I was living down there. And one of my good friends came in and says, like off the cuff, like it happens every Saturday night, "Do you want to meet Coleman Barks?"
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at him and said, "For real?" He says, "Yeah, you want to meet him?" Now, Coleman Barks, for those who don't know, is the reason why the Western world knows anything about Rumi, the poet Rumi.
Mm-hmm.
I am an enormous fan of Rumi and his body of work, and actually the reason why I use whirling in the title of Whirling Metaphysics in my first book, The Whirling Dervishes of the Sufi Faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said something along the lines of, "Hell yeah, I want to meet Coleman Barks." And the way that my buddy knew Coleman, I call him Coleman, don't tell him that, but the way my buddy knew Coleman Barks was, Coleman Barks was his mentor, my buddy's mentor, for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went downtown Athens to a bar called the Manhattan, which I believe Coleman, I think he has a part ownership in, and it's still there. Mm-hmm. It's a groovy little joint, but it looks like there might be a bar brawl that involves gunfire and a knife at any given minute. So we're all sitting in there waiting, and I'd taken my first book with me. I had a copy of my first book with me, and I was going to give it to him, and I had it with me, and I'm clutching it like a kid waiting to see Santa Claus with his Christmas list, you know? And as I'm sitting there, finally, after about 30, 45 minutes, Coleman Barks comes in, and he's dressed looking like, I just mentioned Santa, he looks exactly like Santa Claus, but he was in these these thick coveralls, and
mm-hmm.
He's got this booming voice and this warm, he's everything that you would think he would be, somebody who would translate Rumi, that would bring and be able to, with integrity and zeal, bring Rumi to life in the English language. This man was just, he had this laugh that would just, when he laughed, you would feel it, like it would almost push you back. It was just so deep and baritone. And that laugh of his cracked open so many of my doubts and put the rest and sang to sleep so many of my, my bad thoughts and bad dreams, my waking terrors.
Mm-hmm.
But as we're sitting there and we're all cutting up, and we sat there, we shut that bar down. I mean, we were there for three and a half hours. And I had the book with me. I had my first book with me, and I was going to give it to him. And he's like, "Well, hey, boy, you got to sign it." And I'd never thought about this, Celeste. I was like, "What in the world do you say to Coleman Barks? I really like what you do. It sounds real good and purdy." You know, so what did you write? And I'm like, "Oh God, I don't remember. I can't really," it was just this shock of like, and I just hope I spelled every word right. I'm like, I think I even wrote in print. I usually typically write in cursive, but I was like, "I will always love you." You know, so I don't know what it was that I wrote in, but I just remember that, and he opened it up and he flipped a couple of pages and he read, and he was just like, "Man, you just never would see this coming out of Oglethorpe County. This is really good stuff." And I just, it's not to pat myself on the back, but I just remember this. It wasn't to fight against this, you know, men don't cry kind of thing. But I just remember like he was genuine about it. And my life got caught in my throat in a good way. Not that I was swallowing it down, but I was letting joy out. And he slapped me on the back and he goes, "You need to go to the men's room, boy. So I could cry in private." And I was like, no, sir, I'm going to be all right. And so we kept cutting up for a little bit. And then he goes, "Well, let me give you a copy of each of my new books." And if you go on my Facebook page and go way back, you can actually see that photo of he and I. And we're both kind of leaning sideways because we had a good time while we were there. And I'm holding his two books in front of me, and I've got this smile that's like, life don't get no better than this. and he had this little S10 pickup, and it had been beat down. I don't know where he'd come from, deer hunting or something, but he's like, well, you want to sit in the truck for a minute? And I'm like, sure. I mean, he's like, you're not going to walk away from Coleman Barks. So we were sitting in the truck for a while, and then we realized, like, the guy who introduces us, we had totally ditched in the bar. So I was like, well, man, let me go get my boy. You know, we're going to head to the house. And that's always stuck with me. After that, I had my first reading, official, like, reading at Abbott Books in Athens, Georgia. And about a week before that, I had a buddy of mine who's now a member of the Southern Collective Experience named Peter Restucia get a hold of me. And I don't know, Celeste, if you have friends like this, like you've had them, I mean, it seems like forever, and they say, well, how did y'all meet? And you just, I cannot tell you how Peter and I met. I'm going to surmise that it was on Facebook. That we had kind of bumped into each other on Facebook, but he was from Athens. He had gone to the University of Georgia, graduated from there, and Peter asked me to meet up, and the same thing, God, again, he doesn't put stumbling blocks in our way to punish us. I believe that it truly is to earn something. The more freedom that you want, he doesn't make you hurt for it. God just makes you earn it. He also puts these wonderful stepping stones before you. And Peter Restucia was one of those where we sat. I met him at the Globe and in downtown Athens and the bar down there, and we were sitting across from each other. And, you know, he asked me who some of my favorite poets were. And I remember I was like, Rilke, Rilke, Sandberg, Frost, Langston Hughes, St. Vincent Millay, I could see where his eyes were kind of settling, like, you know, in on this. And later he said, you know, he could see from the list and from our conversation that, again, like Coleman was, it's not that we need or anyone has to have, or they shouldn't demand, I'm good enough from everybody. But when you get those right people in front of you that say, you're on the right path, man, I like what you're doing. Looking back, Coleman Barks and Peter Restucia were two of those folks that just really, you know, because I always have and had and will have the support of my mama. But, you know, your mama has always got that way of, like, you know, like the Clumps movie, like Hercules, 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 where they pat you, where you feel like the compliment somewhere between, like, you're a genius and you need a helmet before you leave the house. You know, like, so somewhere in there, you feel like you always have that. So when you have someone, you know, again, that's always priceless. And I still have that. She's the sweetest lady in the world. She's my angel. And I'm very scared of her, as any good Southerner boy is. But, you know, along the way, Peter and definitely just, I mean, wrap it up, that Peter and Coleman Barks really were two of those that made me see and that the path I was on was the right one, and that the sun was always going to shine. And Coleman Barks and I don't talk often, but Peter and I do. And it's not because I wanted somebody that pandered to me to be around. You know, it's the fact that Peter Restucia is one of the most fantastic men that I've ever met, poets, writers, thinkers. And I learned early, I was like, you know what? I want to have more like Peter around me. And the fact that they aren't yes men or people that are going to tell you what you want to hear, but they're going to tell you what you need to hear. And sometimes that's no. Sometimes I don't get that. And so, you know, they really kind of set the stage for me on who I wanted around me in the future.
Okay. Before we go, you know, we're going to have Cliff read another poem to everyone. And before we go into that, I'm going to take a little commercial break and thank our sponsors. So I appreciate everyone who supports Vertical and everyone who's listening to this program today. So go get your coffee, go get your tea, take a break, and then come back and listen to me and Cliff talk more about poetry and hear more of his poetry.
Still no. Vertical Reading Room, where the story that you will hear will brighten your day or just change your mind. Stop by the Vertical Reading Room for 30 minutes for a good story.
And thank you, Mary. That song, God Only Knows, was from Mary. Simply Mary is the name of the group. A good friend of mine, Mary. I'm always thankful and grateful for our indie artists anywhere in the world to send us music. Mary's located in Phoenix, Arizona. And our commercial was done by Arlene McGuire, who is one of our hosts for The Reading Room. The Reading Room sponsors A Taste of Ink Live today. The Reading Room is accepting submissions of poetry and short stories. And so I can give you a little bit of information. The Reading Room, we started because we had people that we knew that didn't have access to books. They didn't have access to books. They didn't have access to music, a lot of things they love. So what we did was we created a program, can be heard on a mobile app, and can be heard on the computer, that was a little bit entertaining and about reading. This Reading Room goes out to a lot of mature adults and out to our veterans who may be in rehab and kind of just sitting around at VA hospital. So if you'd like to submit a short story or some poetry, you can send it to info@verticallifemagazine.com, and we'll review it, and either we'll have someone read it for you, or you can read it, and it goes into rotation into the Reading Room. Thanks again, Arlene. Thanks again, Mary. And so today, everyone, Taste of Ink Live, we're talking to Clifford Brooks. We've been having a great conversation and listening to his great poetry. So he's going to do another poem for us before we continue on with the program. So, Cliff, you still with me?
I am.
Okay. So you're going to do, the next poem you're going to do is?
The next poem I'm doing is from the book Exiles of Eden. It's kind of a handbook or a guidebook. The design on the front is a compass. It kind of guides you. Those who are familiar with my first book, it came out in 2013, so it's been a hot minute from my first one to this one. So it kind of takes your hand and leads you to the current work, Athena Departs. And though there is a larger excerpt from Athena in Exiles of Eden, there are two poems that you won't find anywhere else, either today or in the future. And one of those is called As I Told My Story to Shane Etter. And Shane Etter is a good buddy of mine. This man, he writes prose like nobody else, and has a story that, with his permission, I would maybe tell him the next time we sit down, but his journey into writing and the fact that, like, sometimes I have a hard time sleeping, and I'll be up in the wee hours in the morning, and, you know, you have that buddy that you reach out to that, you know, not in just bad times, but when, you know, the night gets too dark, things tend to feel a little too close, the stars don't shine so bright, and the world feels a little claustrophobic. It's also a testament from title to poem that, again, I'm extremely literal. If you read my poetry and you think that's what it's about, I promise you that's what it's about. Don't go digging any deeper.
Okay.
I mean, you can if you want to, but you're going to be hitting steel and rock. So the poem is literally me telling my story to Shane Etter. And it goes, 40 years ago, I fell from oblivion and found myself the first son of a song without a sound. Now, my daddy is dashing and my mama is my rock. I am half mad and haunted. While my mama let me question everything, my old man taught me Motown. And the truth, you achieve lasting relief alone. To hope for help from a holy hand will wear a hole in your soul no miracle can fill. It's best to believe in business. Money isn't the essence of evil. My old man made it clear when he said, son, hell is life, but moral ambiguity makes it paradise. Don't fret what you don't pay yet. The South I sing about in church is dead once my bones are fed into the earth. Another haunted from birth, I cannot condone. The myth of my making is murky, and maybe the whole of it is only mad barking of dogs too long. And when I wonder aloud about a lady's balancing influence, I hear my father whisper, boy, your blistered heart will crush her. Staying sane will take up all the strength you can muster. And I whimper, I know, Daddy, as I told my story to Shane Etter.
Great. That was a good one.
Thank you.
Yeah, I like that one. So tell me, what is the biggest thing that people think they know about your subject that isn't so?
What they know about what?
Your writing. Your subject matter when you write.
What people tend to, not in a negative way, I think, but in a more of a stereotypical way, that they expect a poet to be very downtrodden, extremely melodramatic, and very moody, and very, you know, drunk all the time, or incapable of adding, you know, doing math, paying bills. And these things don't irritate me because I can look back through history and see easily why. And again, I am not pontificating from some high hilltop like I've got all the answers, because I don't. But, you know, one of the biggest misconceptions that folks have about not just poets, but I think art in general, is that there are no rules, that that it's all deeply subjective, that those who create it are somehow collateral damage of the inspiration that is in the, what I call the divine fire in you that you either have or you don't have. And so when I open up my readings, when I either with it with being with a Southern Collective experience or, you know, with it being on a solo event, I love to make people laugh because it's almost like number one, I believe that laughter is the music of God. And also if you can get people to giggle a little bit, they don't take it so damn seriously. And it immediately in itself, people say, okay, this isn't going to be somebody who's going to get up there and tell me how terrible life is and then cry a lot and go sit down and mope all day. I don't try to stand up and beat my chest like, you know, I am man, but at the same time, I try to embody the truth of the matter that this whole concoction of left brain, right brain, either you write a sonnet or you can do math, it's not true. If you can tap your foot, if you can sing a song, if you can keep along with the melody, you're doing math in a very real way. And I'm not trying to be trite about that. So, I mean, you know, with me, that's got to be the whole stereotype of what a poet, what an artist emulates, creates. I do cleave to the fact that it's my responsibility to carry the truth of it along. That you keep the song and the poem, and you keep the poem true. But all of the negative attributes that I strive to not carry along with me, and in fact, and if you behave in a way that's in opposition to the status quo, you don't have to prove anything. It's just through your actions and it's through your living. I write life by you and those around you, and trying to stay close to prayer, and that if you do have a faith, if you do have a touch for the Spirit, that you are, you know, that stereotype that you are a judgmental, narrow-minded person is not true either. And so really it's been a joy. It's been a joy to have that responsibility to behave in a way. And a little aside to Mama, just to prove that I'm not trying to be a quintessentially perfect person, when the book took off, my first one, this is true now, my Mama took her pinky finger. And I'm sticking it out right now. She balled the rest up in the thumb. I don't know where she learned this, but she took her pinky finger and she took it from the corner of my eye. She's a little bitty woman. She's like 5'5", and I'm 6'2". So she reaches up and she says, "Baby." I said, "Yes, Mama." And she takes her pinky finger and she traces it in a C shape from the corner of my eye to the side of my mouth and says, "If you ever embarrass me in public, I will cut your face." Just that calm. I don't know what was more alarming was that she stayed so calm, or what, you know, when I looked up, that whole cut, it was from prison. I don't know where she learned it. I don't know. But she, you know, there's that C shape. She was going to cut my face. Not 1 minute did I say, "Oh, Mama, why would you ever?" Because I've had issues behaving. This is just true. I know from childhood, being a little nudist, running around, you know, where's he at? What's he doing? If I'm quiet longer than 5-10 minutes, somebody will come looking. What's that fool doing? What's that fool doing? Where's Cliff? It's kept me out of prison, but at the same time, it's kept me on my toes. So again, it's like the more I can make people laugh, the more I can make people realize that family is important, whether it's by blood or by faith. I feel like I've done my job well.
I have two. I want to check out some of the callers that are on the phone. I'm not sure if they have questions or comments. So the callers who, if I call out the last four numbers on your phone number, let me know if you have a comment or a question for Cliff. And the first one I'm going to call out is 3195. Hello, caller. This is Celeste Decker, and I see you've been listening. Would you like to have, you have a comment or a question for Cliff? Okay. And usually when people don't answer, that's fine. They're just listening and having a great time, and I appreciate your support. The other caller I have on here is 4925. Do you have a comment or a question for Cliff? Okay, that's fine. We have a list of great people just listening to you today, Cliff, and that's great. We thank our audience for being supportive of A Taste of Ink Live all the time. So one of the questions I want to ask you, Cliff, is in writing, what do you find most useful in learning to write, and what was least useful and most destructive?
The most destructive is easy, and that's doubt. Doubt mm-hmm. will murder your work. Doubt breeds mm-hmm. fear. And once you become afraid, and there's enormous, I'm again, I didn't, you know, when the book first came out, I mean, I know I keep hammering on this point, but honesty, I mean, mm-hmm. if you're going to say it, you know, if you're going to write it mm-hmm. down, write the whole story, the good, bad, and the ugly. The one thing you have to be careful of is that you don't traipse too far into the melodramatic or you try to fog the truth with cryptic references or metaphors that are too deep for people to look into. And when you're honest, what I've found is that people will just assume that it's metaphor. So there's safety there, folks, I'm telling you. But there is fear because in prose, when you're writing a short story, a novel, a collection of either, you have a... And I love prose as well. I mean, I write that too, but you're not so exposed. You're not as vulnerable in prose. In poetry, you remove that veil. You can't say like, well, no, that's not, you know, I don't really believe that. You know, I just wrote that into a character that's in this story and that's really them and that's not me. In poetry, Bill Walsh, who is my mentor at Reinhardt University in the MFA program, he and I have a very similar theory that comes down to you're standing naked in poetry before the public. You know, you don't have the fancy attributes of plot line and theme and multiple characters, even though you can have people speaking in poetry, and I think that's important. You have a lot of, you know, of, again, that vulnerability of in being honest as you do in life. So that doubt, that knowledge can make people very afraid to let their work live and breathe amongst the public. But the public is starved to death for that honesty. And so what's helped me the most, what has been most beneficial to me, has been, one, studying the craft, surrounding yourself with positive people that give you constructive criticism, that know something about what they're talking, what they're living, what they're doing, somebody who has been in it and can give you valuable, priceless information, and the practice. Mm-hmm. For me... When I came into poetry, it was really kind of by happenstance. And again, it wasn't by accident. It was just that, mm-hmm. you know, God works in mysterious ways, and this is one of them, that I was kind of nudged into poetry, and I've not done a lot of it. But in the practice of it and finding my voice, I found that I write poetry much like songs are written, in that the melody and the internal rhyme, I feel, is far more important than the stereotypical or the better known in rhyme, where every last word, every other word on the end of the line rhymes within the poem. I feel that that the reader kind of is more easily floated through the poem with more melody and more layers of song. And it's been through practice. I put aside everything. I didn't read any other poetry or poets because I was terrified that I would inadvertently use a phrase or sound too much like somebody. Those 3 years that I lived in Athens, again, it's just the truth. I ate and slept and breathed and lived writing poetry. And that during the day, I would go out and I would cut grass and I would have the poetry in my head, and I'd do landscaping with my uncle and my cousin. And then I would come home alone and sit in my study, and I would tap my foot and listen to music. I guess silence to me is hell. I can't dig it. I can't do it. Mm-hmm. So as I was listening to music, that rhyme started to catch up in my poetry. And as I found folks, and it's the lifeblood behind why I founded this Southern Collective Experience, was to gather up these folks in every genre, from not just the South, but all over, that didn't just yes man me or yes sir me, but in the fact that if I ever stood up and said, "Don't you know who I am?" they would be the first people to bust me in the head with a pipe. But to have that, you have to have that close-knit family of artists around you to give you that nudge, to give you that leg up, and to give you that quiet and support, but also be honest with you and real with you in a productive manner.
Not only do you have the Southern Collective Experience, but you also have your own magazine called the Blue Mountain Review. So tell us more about the collective and the review.
The Southern Collective Experience its mantra is that we're all south of somewhere, and that's not to be trite.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea when I came up with it was not, okay, only people beneath the Mason-Dixon line have anything to say, because that's ridiculous.
All right.
That's just mm-hmm. ridiculous. We open the doors for everyone, and the Southern Collective Experience is a corporation of artists that sound different, that sing different, that have different writing styles, and they come at it from completely different worlds and different backgrounds. But the commonality is that we don't embody this small-minded, cryptic nonsense that so many that then bemoan how small the poetry world is. We don't live that. And again, I'm not saying that anybody is better than anybody else, but the fact that we come together in a way that is to support one another, is to support our crafts. We have painters, we have photographers, we have poets, we have prose writers, we have musicians of all kinds that come together. And as we started talking, and the collective, again, was just, it was at first was supposed to be a family of folks that didn't want to put up with the garbage and the snippy little minds and words of folks that weren't able to live into their dreams. It mm-hmm. became a corporation, and we thought, well, why don't we have a magazine? Not for us, but something in the same line and philosophy, ethos that we live. And so, actually, I mentioned it before, Peter Restucia named it the Blue Mountain Review. Yes, I live in the Blue Mountain Range down here in Georgia, as is, you know, much of the South, but it's to be an example of being on a hilltop, seeing clearly. If you've ever been on the top of a mountain, being able to see, you see for miles, and that's kind of what we wanted to do. And we consider it not just a magazine, but we call it a journal of culture. And that's not to sound smart or not sound like we're apart from the rest, but we strive to provide the public with a real life now without the chokings, without the stifling attributes of romance, to give people a real view of what art is doing today, of what the commonality of it makes it sound like, the universal appeal of good art. And we might have one or two of our members in each issue. Again, you can go online to our website, where we have a Facebook page for the Blue Mountain Review, and you can find the submission guidelines, and it's judged by us, but it's 99% for the public. And we have drawn in people that we never thought. I mean, it's like Christmas every day. You think, oh, my God, you won't believe who just sent me some stuff. You know, it's just people that you see as heroes. It comes out four times a year, and once a season. And we actually have it come out at the end of every season so that people that are submitting can kind of, instead of what I see is projecting out what they hope for the season, they can then instead they can kind of capture what they learn from the season. Not always looking back in retrospect or nostalgia, but I think more in an educated, calm, what have I learned sort of way. The new issue, the spring issue, comes out in about 2-3 weeks, and it's amazing stuff. And we also have Dante's Old South, which is our NPR show that we tape out of Chattanooga, Tennessee, on WUTC. That comes out, the next recording of that is actually, it's this month. It's the last Sunday of this month from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. And it's been a fascinating road to travel.
All right. So what would you say is your personal give back to your community?
If I had to choose between what I loved more, writing or teaching, I couldn't do it. Not because I'm ashamed of the answer, but because both of these professions do take up an equal portion of my heart. And so to give back, though I am paid to do it, if you want to change the world, you educate it. Not with your prejudices or with your ideas or your opinions, but you open the doors to learning to everyone. No matter where they're from, no matter what color they are, no matter what faith they believe, you open that door across the board to say you are better than you think you are. You're better than the society has let you believe. You are smarter than sometimes the government allows or wants you to think. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and I'm not nutty about that kind of thing, but freedom is knowledge, and knowledge is an investment that never stops paying you back. And we have, within the collective, we have what's called pros and cons. The next one of those is May 12th up here in Pickens County from 2 to 4. And those are free and open to the public. And we have a lesson, a tutorial for an hour that's to open it, but split between two people. And we and for the public, and again, these are free events, we teach not, we don't pontificate upon the importance of poetry or bemoan how it's not loved or any garbage like that. We teach the mm-hmm. business of art. We teach, like in the next lesson mm-hmm. we have coming up in the next one, we have how testing in public schools is not sometimes or often not productive. In fact, very counterproductive. And it goes against the grain, not by design, that's not the intent to go against the grain, but it's seen as such because we don't really adhere to what people think of as a poetry reading, you know, or, mm-hmm. you know, on the other side of the spectrum, we're not trying to embody some renegade rebel body, you know, like Star Wars on Earth. We really are just trying to bring back in a very tangible way, a very corporeal capacity, for folks to taste what it's like to be accepted, to learn on their own and to ask questions. And when they leave, you know, we give out cards, you know, different people. We had the last half hour where people are just allowed to talk. No one really thinks mm-hmm. about that, where these things are concerned. That you know, oftentimes if you go for 2 hours, me included, by the end of those 2 hours, if it's nothing but reading and learning, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to hit the house.
Okay.
So we leave that last half hour for people to realize and come up and talk to us. And the speakers are not always people within the Southern Collective Experience. They're from the community that have something mm-hmm. that have something invaluable to share, that they can then come mm-hmm. up in that time and, you know, buy the books of somebody who's there, who's maybe writing and having a book out, but then also talk amongst themselves and also talk with those who have different kinds of lessons to find out more. Because often once people leave, they don't feel like they've got the ability to ask questions. And I very much want to do what my parents allowed me to do, and that's to ask why.
Okay. All right. So I have one more question for you, because I want to hear another one of your poems before we go out today. But my question is, what do you wish that someone would ask you about your book that nobody has?
Oh, Celeste. Okay. What I wish people would ask me more than anything else is mm-hmm. How do you get your book in front of the public?
Great.
The answer to that, say a little prayer. Mm-hmm. The answer to that is the way you get published. Mm-hmm. And I'm not throwing stones at anybody, truly, but the way that you get your books in front of folks is that you follow the path of publishing, not by paying for it, but by having a publisher stand up in your stead financially in that place. The reason mm-hmm. I say that is because if you don't, bookstores won't carry your book. Not out of judgment of how you did it. It could be the most brilliant work in the world, but it comes down to the book depositories. It comes back to the mm-hmm. banks, so to speak, of books that if the bookstore cannot return your books, have that peace of mind that say it's just the wrong bookstore, say the bookstore is going out of business, say that it's just not that's not the right time, perhaps, they have the peace of mind that they can send those books back to a depository instead of having to be stuck with them and mm-hmm. be sitting on money they can't ever get back. Mm-hmm. You know, it's also a matter of you don't just make a post about it. Even if you do get a publisher, the publisher, you know, fronts, the publisher gets your money out there and or your book out there, you need to realize that advertising, merchandising, trademarking, branding, these things are tantamount to success. You know, if you don't okay. trademark yourself, if you don't brand yourself, if you don't put yourself out there, again, by being honest and truly, I mean, I've told the story many times about All the Little Pieces by a guy named Fry. He was on Oprah, and he's a little mm-hmm. pasty dude who got up there and lied through his teeth about living this gangster lifestyle and didn't do anything. Now, yes, there is poetic license. Yes, there is an elasticity of not exaggeration, but poetic license. When you mm-hmm. lie blatantly, that's going to catch up with you. And I always mm-hmm. see it as not if your book will do well, but when it does well. Will your truth stand up to scrutiny? And you have to hold yourself to that bar because lies are difficult. There's a lot of garbage between my ears, and I'm not saying it's all smart, but I cannot keep up with lies. So starting out from the gate being honest, people, again, are starved to death for that. And if you carry that honesty and that business savvy. If you don't know, go find somebody who's doing really well, and you will find more times than not they are more than happy to share how they did what they did. And on the backside, all they can say is no. Go find somebody else. You know, again, and if their answers don't really fit what you're trying to do, go look for somebody who's doing something closer to what you're doing. And these people will have it, because those who do this for a living want to share the stage. The bigger you make the pool, the deeper you make the ocean, the more space you have as a writer, as a poet, as an author, as a painter, as a photographer, the more room you have to swim. And so that's the long answer to that question. But, you know, the business end of things. I love when people ask me about the business end of things as far as writing is concerned.
Okay, great. Well, let's read another one of your poems. And which one are you going to read for us?
All right, the one I'll close out with is a funny one, but it's a little mean. Talking about the business of things, this is a good segue. It's called Poem a Debutante Deserves, and there's a lady once upon a time who came to me about being my manager. And after a few conversations, I found out that she was not interested in managing anything at all in my professional life, but rather in my personal. And I had let it out of the bag that my first book, The Draw of Broken Eyes, and Whirling Metaphysics, The Draw of Broken Eyes was largely a letter to the lady that I talked about from the South that did not come home. Mm-hmm. And I love Lost. And she said something to the effect of, well, if you wrote that many poems for a girl that didn't come home, I deserve 1,000 poems. So I said, really? So this one's called Poem a Debutante Deserves. What you never knew was that there was a classical prelude that kept me in place while we talked. On a lone piano, Liszt was with me as I mellowed. Now, there wasn't a difficulty at first. The tedious moments leaked in later. There was incessant chatter about social clubs, faux laughing tirades about the heart's idiocy, and how many poems a debutante deserves. Deserves? I had a million ideas for our dialogue, but your burdensome luxury was a boomerang that came back and back and back instead of your favorite country song, The Weather, or a comfortable silence. Now, my flow may seem madness, but it is meticulous. Your timeline for us was in a hurry, so I reset the clock. Then you laid down the law, and without an ounce of hate, I ducked out and quickly cleaned the slate. You deserve one poem a debutante deserves.
You're
right.
Very good.
Right. Thank you, ma'am.
Good one.
Thank you, everybody, for being a part of our program today. We appreciate our community of listeners and supporters for Vertical Life Radio. I'd like to thank Charles Clifford Brooks for being our featured guest today, Team Vertical for volunteering and planning and production of A Taste of Ink Live. And next week, for National Poetry Month, our guest will be Global IM with Naoko Fujimoto, Chloe Martinez, Deshimba, Jess, and Shadab Hadi. Follow us on Blog Talk Radio. You can listen to the tape portion of this program later on today, and we will be also sharing that on our social media. And you can read a full interview with Charles Clifford Brooks at Vertical Life Magazine at verticallifemagazine.com, and that's vertical with a K. Thank you again for listening to us, and we're going to go out today with a song from Six Man, and I hope you enjoyed our program today. Thank you, and we'll see you soon. And here is Eyes Wide.
Above average, I'm a savage.
Keep my eyes wide and
the daytime as well. Kept me focused on what's real and nothing else. Keep my eyes wide in the daytime as well. Kept me focused on what's real and nothing else. Keep my eyes wide in the daytime as well. Kept me focused on what's real and nothing else. Keep my eyes wide in the daytime as well. Kept me focused on what's real and nothing else.
Me and Tommy together's like P-Rock. I see your smooth. A DJ Premier with Guru. Yo, it's tangible. We too hard. You can't handle us. Hate paparazzi. In the camera, the cypher, and took out my leaders with a rifle. Insurance went down on blacks just like Geico. We fight for the dream, amongst some other things. The smoke out the lobby and evacuate the scene. I stretch like miracle veins when I bang. For the money, they all go bonkers in the same. This Michigan hip-hop, legendary and tip-top. Driving down the 131, rolling the black like I'm vigilant. Look at the time and know it's serious. Music should sound like this so you can feel it. The pillage, need more OGs to raid the village. Young and back talk, they need your crack.
Keep my eyes wide in the daytime as well. Kept me focused on what's real and nothing else. Keep my eyes wide in the daytime as well. Kept me focused on what's real and nothing else. Keep my eyes wide in the daytime as well. Kept me focused on what's real and nothing else. Keep my eyes wide in the daytime as well. Kept me focused on what's real and nothing else.
Hey, yo, I speak braggadocious. Lyrically, I'm ferocious. Niggas leave with broken backs and cornucopia. Assist me. You couldn't do nothing but piss me off like the light. We get illuminate the dark, a gun move pioneer just like a lot of dark. Man, I kill ya if you ain't familiar. Raised by drug dealers and live with addicts. Kept my mind open and focused on nothing else. The pressure was cooking me, cops kept booking me. Niggas was feeling my music and lining would look at me. Sharp like a blade, cut the color of Kool-Aid. Drips out the body, faster than it stays. Bitch, you better walk that flame, get off our shit. Cause dudes like you can get hit with AR clips. Consistent, relentless, a little bit.